what did happen? Okay. See, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Darmanish. They were all dead. The others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter, and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean, and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then, there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to the Storm and Lost Rewatch Podcast for Season 6, Episode 12, Everybody Loves Hugo. And hey guys, what wing of a museum would you like named after you as one of the hosts of the Storm Podcast, or as, you know, someone who donates money to museums? My name is Dave Gonzalez. I would like the Storm Podcast version, and I would like the Hall of Gemstones, where all the pretty things are, and where I like to wander around as a child.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I would like to dedicate my name to a wing of a museum that centers on food history so that people could take fajita field trips to the museum, which is my favorite line from this episode.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to have a wing of a museum named after myself, it would definitely be the IMAX Theater. So that someone like Hank Schrader from Breaking Bad could go over to the Hall of Gemstones and hang out with Dave and then go see a movie. And then after the movie, have a fajita field trip in Joanna's wing. I'm assuming that we're all in the same museum.
Yeah, that's a whole afternoon.
That's a great day. What a great day.
If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or flashing sideways and visiting the Cork Island for the very first time. Because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, we have a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. And then there's a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers, discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device, you will see time codes where each one of those sections start, in case you want to skip around, revisit, all those fun things. For the final season of Lost, we've shifted to releasing this podcast on Saturday evenings in the U.S. after our group live watch in our Storm Slack. How do you join the live watches in that Storm Slack, you ask? Why? You go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you will find ways to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and depending on what level you choose, you get more and more bonus content. And when you subscribe for the very first time, you get instant access to our previous years of bonus content, which include extra interview bits, bonus podcasts, and various oddities. This month of July, one of your bonuses you get is a chance to join us for our final movie club. Isn't that right, Joanne?
It is, yeah. We are watching this Sunday, right? Or tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Is listening to this? We're watching Sneakers, a perfect film in my view. I'm really excited to show that one. And I'm excited, like, you know, for the last hurrah. Some folks have expressed some sadness that this is the end. But, you know, I think we'll go out on a high note. That's going to be really fun. Yeah, so you can join our Patreon to watch episodes of Lost with us, watch seminal Robert Redford films with us, whatever the case may be. You can also email us. hostthestormpodcast.com. We like that. We got a couple great emails this week. You can also write us a review. We do have a new review this week, if memory serves, and I'm going to read it to you. folks, I'm going to read it to you right now. Are you ready? This is definitely not me stalling because I didn't have it pulled up. Okay, here it is. Gabe says, it's Gabe I've Been Stormed H from the United States. So even his even his display name seems to be dedicated to our podcast. All right, 5 stars, the best podcast about the best show. I love Lost. I'm a chronic rewatcher, and I've found that Lost is a show I can revisit at any point in my life and find ever new and rewarding pieces to chew on. But just like any good art, it really comes alive when experienced in community. That's what The Storm has given me over the last 6 months that I've been binging it. Every episode, I realize that I missed something that I missed on previous watches, criticisms that I never would have thought to have, and overall, a deeper appreciation for a rich, if flawed, piece of television. Neil is the rock of this podcast with thoughtful, sage perspective at every turn. Dave adds the edge with his strong opinions and sometimes wild theories. And Joanna is simply the best podcast host. Do yourself a favor and give The Storm a listen. You won't be disappointed. Love that, Neil Miller, that was, the rock.
That was very nice.
Neil the Rock Miller, as he's known in Hollywood. So let me hop over to some of these emails. Yes. Okay. Sorry. I just saw the live watch thing and I got confused again about time. Anyway, next week, as you're listening to this, I, Joanna, will be hosting the Last Recruit live watch. But what is time anyway? All right. So let us read some emails. Let's start with one from Aaron. Aaron wrote in, Aaron wrote in an email that just says, regarding solenoids, check this out, and sent us a link, which I'll send to you guys. But just, like, thank you guys for sending us solenoid links. Like, that just makes me thrilled about who is listening to this podcast and who is writing into this podcast. So thank you for that. All right, this one comes from Alex, and Alex says, I never thought I would actually send an email in, but are you guys ready for this? But after hearing your shock regarding listeners being in middle or high school when Lost started...
Oh, no, he was 11!
I couldn't off any longer. When Lost started, I was almost 2 years old.
Oh!
Some of my earliest memories are of my parents watching Lost, particularly Ana Lucia's death. And I remember finally watching the whole thing for the first time and putting the pieces together in middle school. Now rewatching as a very young adult, I have so much more appreciation for everything the show did and love listening to you guys every week. I'm excited for whatever you guys have planned after Lost. But I'm really hoping it's The Leftovers. Please, I beg you, give me an excuse to rewatch that masterpiece. Thank you guys for the endless hours of entertainment through quarantine, Alex. Alex, thanks for that email. Makes me happy.
Two.
Imagine processing the Ana Lucia death scene as like a middle schooler.
Like a three-year-old, though.
Oh.
Tough break.
It makes me happy, actually, when I hear from folks who were very young and lost, because that means we're not just, like, talking to folks, you know, our own age, for sure. But, like, you know, it's fun to widen the umbrella of listenership. Okay, Michael writes in, he says, longtime listener, first-time caller, hoping to share some thoughts before it all comes to an end. I came to the podcast as a follow-on from listening to Game of Thrones podcast with Joanna and Dave Chen. When Lost originally aired, I missed the boat on the first season and never really had a chance to catch up. It seemed fairly obvious that this was a series that you need to start at the beginning, so resolve to catch up later in time. I viewed the various iterations of the subsequent Lost zeitgeist over time from afar, pretty much only gleaning about the show that there was a hatch involved, there were a lot of flashbacks, and that the ending was fairly controversial and not necessarily in a good way. Flash forward to being a Netflix streaming subscriber, this is for Lost moved over to Hulu, and taking the opportunity to delve into Lost, and I loved it, taking care to not binge, preferring to spread my ice cream over multiple sittings rather than eating it all at once. My only disappointment was that I was watching after all the hubbub had occurred. The podcast rewatch is a great opportunity to create a facsimile of the Lost community that existed during the original airing, and I love it. I get exposed to lots of questions and controversy that I didn't know existed during the original airing, and I'm having a great time. I've fallen 5 or 6 episodes behind the podcast schedule. Insert Desmond as a constant reference here. But I've wanted to stay more or less true to some sort of weekly schedule as it allows me to watch, participate in the podcast, and absorb each episode rather than burn through a bunch of them quickly. My only other point is an extension of points made earlier in the podcast, but I think are much more relevant as the series gets further down the line. Lost was a great example of network television at the time, both for good, bigger budgets, giant audiences, and for bad. Script interference, casting interference, lots of interference. I think two loose analogies related to I think of two loose analogies related to television and movies. One involves Lou Wasserman, former head of MCA, whose strict philosophy towards movie making, running time, budget, resembled the bureaucratic necessities of network television at the time. The other is from an interview of Billy Wilder by Cameron Crowe, where he states that his movies were somehow better / funnier because he was constantly trying to think of ways around different studio standard rules. A similar dichotomy seems to exist in anecdotes you've told in the podcast about Lost. The series' pitch is a survivor-like show, when it was secretly much different. The complications with casting regarding Michael Keaton, Kate as the primary protagonist, etc. Casting and subsequent decasting decisions impacting Ana Lucia and Libby. The need to write the script seemingly almost on a weekly basis in the early days. The emergence of the internet as an influence on both fans and the network. Alike the hesitancy to shift into hard science fiction, and then the controversial decision to have a planned ending to the series rather than just wring every nickel from the show until no one effectively cares anymore. Despite all of this, the show has a network feel that seems almost essential, at least at the time, in order to give the show the gravitas necessary to pull it off. Just like your podcast. Anyway, I just want to take the opportunity to let you know I'm a fan of your efforts. Keep doing what you're doing. So thanks for that, Michael. And it is good to remember. I think we're pretty good at remembering like timeline context of like when the story comes out and what feels progressive then and what feels regressive now and stuff like that. But I think I at least sometimes forget to compare it to other network shows versus cable shows that came since. Do you know what I mean? And It's just so incredibly different from anything else that was happening on the network. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Yeah.
And then everything was like Lost. And then right. Heroes came along. And then everything was like Heroes.
But also Heroes was like Lost.
Right. But also Heroes was like Lost.
Yeah.
What a grand world we lived in.
The last email I want to read is from Jeff, at least in this section, is from Jeff, who says, I told you guys this already off air, but I think it's a fun fact. On the topic of Lost actors and other projects, another fun connection the show has to something else is Rose and Ernst are in The Fugitive. They're both U.S. Marshals working for Tommy Lee Jones. Ernst returns for the spinoff. Rose does not. Also, I think Faraday and Frogert are in Twister together. That's all. Hope everyone is doing well. Jeff. And then Jeff says, P.S. was thrilled by Dave's when I suggested Battlestar Galactica as your next show. Please seriously consider it. Selfishly, I've seen it all and don't want to add to my pile of new stuff to watch because I certainly don't want to stop listening to y'all. So thank you, Jeff. I promise that like we're still having conversations about what we're doing next. And I just promise you all that we are thinking very hard about what we could do to keep this fun community alive and go and kicking and just churning. Does that make sense? Does that
yeah
feel
to
right?
Keep the party rolling.
Let's keep the party rolling. All right, as I mentioned, I'll be back next week for the live watch for Last Recruit. You can join me in the Slack for that. Hope to see you all tomorrow Sunday for Sneakers. My voice is my passport, verify me. In the meantime, Neil Miller, what happened on Lost this week?
Oh, quite a few things happened on Lost this week. This episode, Everybody Loves Hugo, was written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz, and directed by Daniel Attias. It aired on April 13th, 2010, and it takes place on day 10 following the arrival of Ajira Flight 316. We begin on the island as the beach crew gets ready to go blow up the Ajira plane. Hurley has a chat with Libby's very well-kept grave, lots of bright flowers. Then Ghost Michael shows up and says that if they blow up the plane, everyone else will die. And then Ilana explodes. And then, after Richard insists that they should carry on with the dynamite plan, Hurley sneaks off and blows up the Black Rock. After Hurley insists that the best next move is to go and talk to Locke, Richard takes Ben and Miles and heads out to try and finish the whole dynamite plan. Elsewhere on the island, Saeed delivers Desmond to the Man in Black so that they can go on a walk through the jungle. Along the way, they both see the strange young man that keeps popping up. And at the end of their journey, Flock throws Des down a well. As Hurley and the crew trek through the jungle at night toward Locke's camp, Michael shows up to point them in the right direction. He also explains that the whispers are the souls of people who died on the island and aren't ready to move on, and he also says that he's sorry about killing Libby. It's a big moment for Michael. Later, at Flock's camp, Hurley and the gang arrive and forge a temporary truce so that everyone can talk it out. And after 23 episodes apart, main timeline Jack and Flock are face to face once again. They haven't seen each other since Jack gave Locke's dead body his grandpa's shoes. In the Flash Sideways, we learn a little more about the luckiest man in the world, Hugo Reyes, a business leader, a philanthropist, and a huge supporter of paleontology. But as his mother reminds him, he hasn't been the luckiest in love. Later, after a blind date no shows on him, he has a strange encounter with a woman named Libby, who is a patient at Santa Rosa that happened to wander away from her doctor during a fajita field trip. She indicates that she remembers him from somewhere, another life, perhaps. Shaken by the experience, Hurley tries to drown his sorrows in a bucket of chicken before being interrupted by Desmond, who shows up and encourages him to follow his gut, find out more about Libby's story. And while visiting Libby at Santa Rosa after making a very large donation, nothing is really cleared up for Hurley, but it does inspire him to take Libby on a date to a beach, where they share a genuine moment and a kiss that triggers Hurley's memories of his other life. It all ends back in the Flash Sideways, where Desmond has moved on to the next target on his list. Only this time, he greets John Locke by running him over with a car. Yeah, it's quite a lot to take in there at the end. Fun fact about this episode, Jorge Garcia's real-life dog, Nunu, appears in one of the pictures with Hugo at the beginning of the episode. Also included in that opening montage is real baby pictures of Jorge Garcia. So delightful. This week's calm question for my beloved co-hosts. Here's a hypothetical. You're stuck on an island of mystery, and you have to choose who to follow. Option A, the immortal guy who wants to blow up an airplane. Or option B, the guy who can speak with the dead and wants to go have a peace summit with a murderous column of black smoke. Which team are you joining? Well, let's start this week with Dave. Are you going with old Richard or Hurley?
I mean, because I've watched Lost, unlike Ben and Miles, I'm gonna stick with Hurley. It may seem, you know, out there, but it's Hurley, man. He's not gonna intentionally hurt anybody.
That's so funny. I have a contradictory comment that I will leave for the storm, but okay, follow-up question for you, Neil. Mm-hmm. Do I currently know where Cindy is? If I know that Cindy's with Locke and Hurley wants to take me to Locke, I'm going with Hurley.
Wow.
Because as we have established, Cindy is the survivor, and as Cindy goes, so goes my nation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it depends. Like, if you're Miles, Miles knows that Cindy's with Locke.
Yeah.
But he chooses... What Richard,
an idiot.
Anyway.
What a fucking idiot. What a jabroni.
Yeah, I don't know. I would just say that, like, lately Richard seems very high strung. Like, he
it's
seems
true.
To be freaking out.
It's true.
So, Hurley, at least at the point where they need to decide which team they're going with, Hurley seems to be the calmest operator. And so, yeah, I mean, I would almost certainly go with Hurley.
We have a episode where I feel like a lot of large things happen. Falling downs, blowing ups, and that's just on the island. There's, you know, back in the sideways, we're continuing the permeating barrier between the sideways and here as Hurley gets kissed to life or into his second life by Libby. So we're getting some more hints. I really think this is another solid Edward and Adam do a Hurley episode installment in season six here. I'm not super everything that the man in black says at this point I'm just assuming is a lie, but also he's the only one besides Michael, I think, in this episode who's still trying to communicate rules to people. It seems like a lot of the people that are otherwise, who used to be our people dictating rules, both Richard and Alana, here very quickly get their ideas literally blown up, or in some cases, themselves. So I like Neil's question about splitting up teams on the island, because I would like to go back to, let's say we did go to Flock. How much do we trust him and the idea of this television show being thematic, that everybody still needs to be together. This is the same thing that Eloise told them when they had to get back to the island. And I'm glad Neil also brought up the shoes, because that's how closely things had to mirror in order for this island trick to work. Does the same trick work getting off the island?
I don't know why you keep asking these questions in the calm that we can't really answer.
I will say that at this point, at this point, it seems like the most true thing he says in this episode, which, like, that makes sense. Like, you all need to be together. But as to whether or not that can be achieved, I think the look between Jack and Flock at the end suggests maybe not.
Yeah.
What's the biggest explosion this episode? Alana or the fireworks between Big Lock and Jack?
Right. So, I mean, I think it's a fun. It's fun because we're following Hurley's leadership with his team, and he is taking a huge risk. And I love that. I think one of my favorite scenes is him and Jack talking, and Hurley admitting that, like, yeah, Jacob totally wasn't there, and I'm really sort of out over my skis on this one. And yeah, I think you can believe what Flock says, that they all need to be together, but also be very skeptical that that's actually going to happen, because he is a tricky one, that man in black, and I don't think we should trust him, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he seems to at least be getting somewhat closer, because he has, you know, like, not willingly, obviously, but Ben and Miles don't seem to be part of his plan or list. So them going off with Richard seems to be a net zero in terms of what the smoke monster camp wants. How about this, Joanna? Do you like Sawyer just being around to make comments here? Or do you think there was a better camp character to use to observe Locke talking to his stick?
Well, everything in the frickin'... Lock camp is like where our interesting characters go to do nothing.
Kate just glares through most of this episode
until she sees Jack, and then
sure,
like a big old smile. Okay. Well, that I am going to answer your question with a question of my own, which is something that I want to talk about in this episode specifically, which is this idea of arcing out. I can't remember if we've talked about it. We have talked about it on this show, but this is an idea. I'll just recap. This is an idea that I picked up via Michael Waldron, via Dan Harmon, about characters who have, you know, finished their growth. And now what do you do with them? They have arced out. And I think when I look at this series on a week-by-week basis with you guys, I think what we're dealing with, the reason why a lot of island stuff feels so inert, is that almost all of the characters on the island have arced out. Sawyer
Ooh,
has arced
camp is an arc out camp. I like that.
Sawyer has arced out. You know what I mean? Like Kate has a mission. She's trying to get like Claire back with her, but she is like arced out. Like that is about like staying and remaining in family. Do you know what I mean? So like Kate has arced out. I would argue that almost all of our characters, I mean, Sun and Jin still need to see each other, but like that has been like, that's not about growth for them.
Once that happens, they've arced out.
Yeah, Saeed's a zombie. Desmond's kind of a different kind of zombie. Claire's, you know, like, whatever. The only characters... And Richard feels like he has gone on his journey, and that's why Abiturno is so good, because that was a character that still had, like, some movement that he needed to do. But, like, it's Jack and Hurley. You know, and Locke isn't Locke, right? So it's just Jack and Hurley. And Hurley's doing a lot of arcing in this episode, I think, like in terms of stepping into a leadership role. And Jack is doing a lot of arcing in this episode in terms of taking a step back. But I think that's why you have such a problem with the on-island stuff being interesting, and why they keep doing stuff like just, never mind the temple. We're like, let's blow up Alana.
Oh, hey, Desmond's here. And Darwell.
But the reason why... this season, why some stuff works so well in the season, is because they just like Loki, you know, shook the Etch-a-Sketch on the arcs in the sideways, right? So those are our characters running their arcs again over in the sideways, which is why not just the cast returning, but like the fact that those are character movement episodes is why it's fun or moments is why it's more much more fun to spend time in the Sideways, I think, than it is on Island this season. I don't know. What do you guys think about that sort of idea?
No, I agree. And I think it's there's such a, I don't know, this may not actually be true if you were to like calculate how much time is passing in the Sideways and on the Island, but it feels like things on the Island are going a lot slower, right? Like there's stuff happening in the Flash Sideways. We're now on this like mission with Desmond where he's like giving Hurley advice and hitting John Locke with his car, and he's got all this stuff to do. And then on the Island, it's like he gets thrown down a well. But also it's only been 10 days and it feels like more should have happened on the Island. And yeah, they're just sort of treading water around these last few characters that need to sort of work out their shit.
Get to camp arc out, finish the series. I like it. I think we should, pause for a moment at, Alana's blowing up death and ask ourselves, did Alana work?
No.
Mm.
And I think they know she didn't, and then they blew her up because she wasn't.
And then they have Ben lampshade it really, really quick and on the way to the Black Rock before they blow something else up.
There's just so many, and that means everyone on Ajira, Caesar, Alana, and the various Alana henchies, none of them really matter, right?
Right.
It's just Frank. Like, we got Frank, and that's what we got off Ajira. And we got Bernard, and that's what we got off the Tailies. But, like, nothing really of consequence came from those things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, I think we've talked about it before, that, like, there was, like, a rumor or an idea at one point that Alana would be, like, more closely tied with Jacob, like, be Jacob's daughter. And I think that could have been potentially more interesting. But I think what they end up with here is like, we need one of our losties, one of our original losties to begin to take charge. And we also have Richard, who's, you know, leading his own plan. We just don't need three leaders in one camp, right? So,
especially since Alana doesn't know anything.
Yeah, like, she's run out of information to give us.
That's the weird choice they make with the character. She has this mission, but her mission is based on like bullet points that are so vague that most of the time she's just improvising. And that's they didn't allow the character to have the answers. Presumably, I'm going to guess, because when she was introduced, they didn't want to give out any answers because it was last season. Mm-hmm. But now that we're living here and that we, you know, start out a whole Jacobless season or a dead Jacob season, that she like doesn't have any additional information. All the people that can communicate with the Island or communicate with Jacob are not her. They're Richard and Hurley and maybe Miles. And it's an odd choice for a character, but seeing her get artsed is a good shock.
It is pretty wild that they decided to just reuse that same gag that they did with Arst.
Well, it kind of reminds me of, you know, we talked before in the Desmond episode about like remixing the greatest hits, in episodes. And so like Arst blowing up is a Hurley moment for me, right? Cause it's like, dude, you got some Arst on you. Like, so it feels like an element of a Hurley moment. And like you talked about this being an Adam and Eddie episode, and like it feels very, this episode feels very Dave to me, the Sideways stuff, for sure.
That's what I was wondering what connections to Dave meant in the notes, but
yeah.
The episode
is connected to Dave. Well, plus you've got Libby's husband, Dave, and also, David Reyes is not there. Interesting. Why is he there? Anyway, we can get to three degrees of separations from a David at any given point on Lost, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, it feels like her blowing up is not just a way to get rid of her, but it just makes her look stupid. She's got this like that goopy sweating dynamite in her bag, and she's just shoving water bottles on top of it. Like, what is she? Is Alana dumb? Like, what the fuck, you know?
I mean, I guess I could see after the Jack and Richard BlackRock showdown, the like this also being something that like even people Jacob has like favored aren't safe. but it doesn't play that way. It does play as her being dumb.
Right. Because, well, you know, we know that, like, Alana's not a candidate. Alana's not, she doesn't have Richard. She didn't get touched like Richard. So
she did get touched.
She got healing touched.
She got healing touched, but she's not like immortal. Like,
well,
Richard.
We know that now because she blew up. But, you know, maybe that's the seed of this idea that didn't turn out very well. Could have just been like, well, we have to take Alana off. And someone's like, well, maybe Alana's immortal. And they're like, well, how do we prove that, like, that doesn't matter? How, back to the idea with Jack's appendix, that, like, in order for something to go, like, accidentally wrong on the island, you're not in the island's favor. Because, like, bad accidents don't happen on the island. Or if they do, they heal you up real fast. They gin your leg.
It makes me wonder what Arst did to piss. Makes me wonder what Leslie Arst did to piss off the island.
Well, it's also interesting that, like, whenever you hear something like the island isn't done with you yet, in the past or whatever, like, sometimes I think about, like, that being the island's will, whatever that is, being aligned with Jacob's will. Now, I know Jacob's dead, but, like, it still feels like the island blowing up Alana is something that, like, it feels like Jacob should never let happen, since he, like, even more actively than anyone else brought her there, right? He didn't just, like, crash her ship. He, like, went to her hospital and was like, you gotta come to this island. Like, I don't like it. Alana just feels like a real waste of time, a waste of a nice actress, and a big mistake.
I'm very glad, knowing her whole arc, that she wasn't Jacob's daughter, because we already know Jacob's a bad dad. You don't need to
you don't need shunt it home to, that like, much. Where double it's like, bad dad.
I had a daughter, but I'm also in, like, a, you know, millennia long search for an heir. So, like, the daughter less important.
She's a woman, so
I do like the second explosion. I love Hurley's gambit.
Yes.
Which reminds me of the Numbers episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love Hurley. You know, it's not just about him sort of taking charge in this episode, but, like, making significant decisions completely on his own. Like, I'm going to blow up the Black Rock and everyone's just going to have to deal with it. So I like that. Also, RIP Black Rock. You've been with us since season one.
Yep.
Now you're gone. That's another character that is arced out after Abiturno is the Black Rock.
The Black Rock.
Yep.
Yeah, it had a big moment.
Yeah, I mean,
everybody
took out
kept
a whole
thinking
statue.
It was hell, and then it died in a fireball. Speaking of things from season one that arc out, let's say, Joanna, what did we learn about those pesky whispers?
We find out the whispers. We find out from Michael. Hey, Michael's here.
Hey, Michael's here. Hey.
Hey. We find out from Michael that the whispers are the voice of the dead trapped on the island who can't move on for one reason or another. They're in some kind of purgatory, which is sort of like, you know, one of the main theories for what the show was to begin with, was that this was purgatory all along. I want to read an email we got from our listener Miguel about the whispers. And Miguel says, I think this is a calm email. He says he tried to make it calm friendly, so we'll see if we have to bleep anything. He writes us a nice paragraph saying thank us for everything. He was 22 when the show ended, so you can feel good about that. All right. So anyway, he goes, I felt the need to write you now that we're at the end of Everybody Loves Hugo. I remember when the episode aired, many viewers were angry about the whispers reveal. Michael walking out of the jungle, basically saying, yep, whispers, hashtag dead people, got people so mad as to the way the writers were presenting answers to long-awaited mysteries, but also the quality of the answers we were receiving. For some, this was perceived as a slap in the face as they, quote-unquote, deserved answers to the mysteries of the island. As we approach the end, I would like to hear your thoughts about what a creator owes their audience, especially in the context of network TV. As the show is winding down, many mysteries from previous seasons remained and creators kept being asked about them, even the ones that had already been answered. Looking at you, Polar Bears, do you believe inorganic answers absolutely need to be incorporated in the narrative to please an audience? Would Lost have been better off not answering some of these longstanding mysteries that the creators felt the need to address in the final season, mostly due to popular demand? Tried to keep this email as calm-friendly as possible. Keep up the amazing work. Looking forward to what show you guys pick next. I second the fringe vote. Miguel, a French-Canadian who has only succeeded in breaking 83% of all the bones in a human body and therefore is not worthy of being another yet.
Wow.
Miguel, I would like to hear that story about breaking 83% of all bones in a human body. Email me when you get a chance. His last name is Savage, so that's fitting.
Oh, wow.
Or Savage. I just, since he's French-Canadian, I put a French twist on it. So, yeah. So, this the quality of the answers here, and reading all the recaps that came out this week, it seemed that people were similarly like, that felt like a really clunky way to reveal that, and kind of a something that lands in a clunk in an otherwise really nice scene between the great Harold Perrineau and the great... Jorge Garcia. So what do you guys think about that reveal?
I can see where, actually, I remember being one of those people. So I definitely recall being angry about it. But I do think, to go to Miguel's more direct question, I think even if you were to ask the creators, they would have had put fewer direct answers in the sixth season of Lost if they got a chance to do it again. I definitely think it was a pressure, especially after season 5 was like this perfect little time travel bubble that made you want to ask those questions and then provided answers to them. Like, you know, isn't the compass in a time loop? And then it's like, yeah, it is. And you feel good and things are great. But the show was operating as a mystery show that didn't know when it was going to end for the first 3 seasons. So there's going to be some stuff left along the way, some temple stuff. That, you know, doesn't make any sense. And I think we would have gotten a much more spiritual, vague, emotional set of answers in season 6 had the creators done it this time. But because they didn't really know, like as we talked about way back in the email section, this is network TV at a time where network TV kind of isn't doing this. Like every time they were talking about the finale leading up to it, Damon and Carlton were like praising how good The Sopranos was because that was one of the few shows that had been allowed to end and it did something unexpected that, you know, people liked. And they knew they had a long Sawyer and Kate made rock runway to land this show on and tried their best. But do I like the whispers? No, I especially don't like the whispers and being paired to Michael in this way. Because it traps Michael in a way that feels weird. And, like, you could have had Michael say things to Hurley without answering the whispers because Hurley sees dead people that travel around with him. So I feel like it was slamming a cameo and an answer together, which just came into nothing.
Mm.
What do you think, Neil?
I think I agree that it's the way they executed it is a little clunky. And this is probably one of the answers that we didn't necessarily need. But I also don't completely dislike that that's what the whispers are, right? Because we've had a bunch of damn ghosts on this island. And
Have we?
Well, yeah. Well,
we have a shapeshifter.
It feels like we have had a bunch of ghosts on this island.
It's like Ben's mom.
Ben's mom.
Richard's wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, but like people that are seen by Hurley, those all accept as like ghosts. And like Ben's mom doesn't seem to make any sense, but...
I'm with you on right, that. She didn't die on the island.
She didn't die on the island. But like Ben never sees a ghost again.
Sure. I mean, and the island has a pretty high body count. And it has a significant sort of gravitational power, I suppose. So I don't know. I see a certain logic in it that it's not complete nonsense to me that it's like, oh, there were people whose journeys to this island ended poorly. And for some reason, this island can sort of keep them here, and that's their sort of torture before they can move on. I mean, that also feels like it's like that's the point where in today's media landscape, they would be setting up the sequel series, which like the sequel series is about how do we help these ghosts on the island move on, you know?
Joanna, but, off that, I have a question for you. What? Is there a better character than Michael to use for this reveal?
Rousseau.
Okay.
Rousseau, yeah.
She's got some unfinished business.
She is unfinished.
Why couldn't
business.
It have been Libby's ghost, I guess, is also a question.
I think maybe that would have been confusing. Plus, why would Libby still be, like, what has Libby done that she needs to hang out there for? I mean, what has Rousseau done? Anyway, like, Michael being the one with, like, blood on his hands and so stuck in a island purgatory kind of makes sense. But Rousseau has connections to the Whispers. But, like, what, I mean, the ghost rules, listen, it's never going to make sense. Ghost rules are never going to make sense on Lost because they change the rules all the time. I want to, can I bring in something that I was watching this conversation that Damon Lindelof had with Adam Savage, I think it was, right before The Leftovers season one premiered. So I was roundabout way of saying that, like, I was talking to Alan Sepinwall on the podcast I was doing about Loki, about this thing that Vince Gilligan used to talk about when making Breaking Bad, which is this idea of, like, they would just create scrapes for themselves, writing scrapes for themselves at the end of a season and not know how to get out of it. So, like, the most famous example in Breaking Bad being like this giant gun that's in Walt's trunk, and they show the gun at the end of one season and they put that in there without knowing at all what they planned for it. They just sort of put it in there and then they figured out a very satisfying answer, I think. And so in that way, I've always pushed back against people who say, like, you have to have a plan in order to write a good show. You have to have a plan, or else it's bad writing. And I just don't agree with that. Like, TV shows should be pliable by nature because they're so long running. We talk all the time about how Lost, like, reacts to something like Michael Emerson joining the cast or stuff like that. Like, Dim Lindelof in this conversation was talking about, he brought up that anecdote from Vince Gilligan. And then he was talking about how he's like, but when you're writing a mystery show, I don't think you can just figure it out over the summer hiatus. I think if you're going to drop clues about something, you need to know what you're pointing towards. And then what's funny about, like, leading into The Leftovers, though, is that, like, that show is all, you know, not to spoil it, but that show is all about defiantly not answering a mystery. The theme song for seasons 2 and 3 is a song called Let the Mystery Be, which seems like very much in dialogue with Lost, right? So, so that idea of, like, do I think the show would be better if certain things weren't answered? Yes. I think there's a lot of stuff that, like, to literalize the answer is to rob it of some of its, like, mystery and magic. That's why, like, the end of Twin Peaks, The Return, is so evocative, because, like, you don't know what the fuck is going on. And if David Lynch...
I definitely watched a end of something.
And if David Lynch ever, like, sat down to tell me what the fucking electricity meant, I don't want to hear it. It would take some of the magic out for me. So... I don't know. That's what I was thinking about when I was reading Miguel's email about the Whispers.
Yeah, like I said, it's definitely one of the answers that we probably didn't need. But I do like having Michael back. I think that's a fun part.
It was
great. We also didn't need to do the Whispers thing to get Michael back, you know?
Yeah, totally. You got a character who could see ghosts, and the ghosts show up at convenient times. This is a great convenient time for Michael to show up. He's got something to do that isn't Walt-based. I'm sure, you know, that's nice.
So he's got that going for him.
He's got that going for him. all right. Let's jump to this. Oh, wait. I guess we should go back to Fluck, which we've talked about jokingly. But ask Desmond some questions. Desmond says, like, of course, you're John Locke. And Locke's like, let me show you something. It's this well. It's a really old... And then down the well he goes.
One of my favorite things about this scene is that moment where Flock gets really sort of confused by Desmond's lack of fear about his situation. Like, the moment he realized that Desmond is now just, like, vibes all the time. He's like, you know what? I need to throw this dude down a well. Like, that... This is taking it way too far. You need to... have a reverent sort of fear of me.
If you don't have a fear of me, And yeah, you're not Saeed or Claire. What can I do with you?
It's too dangerous for the man in black to have anybody just vibing around this island.
Oh,
except for Saeed, I guess, because he's vibing.
Well, that's his vibe.
Pure darkness at this point.
He doesn't feel anything. That's like the opposite of vibing. He's a negative vibe.
Desmond's like, I feel everything, brother.
All right. Before we leave the island, there is one final note here that's all in caps.
We should just say really quickly that Desmond screams or yells, at least when he falls down the well, which is our indication that, like, whatever Zen vibes only attitude he has, it's not because he knows exactly what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Didn't see that one coming, did you, Desmond, old boy? So, yeah.
I hope he's okay down there. Look, it was a long way to fall.
That lengthiest fall down. Torch went like out of. We didn't see it. The bottomless well. Yeah.
For all we knew, he fell directly into a rental car. Sideways.
Wasn't it the last time someone fell down that well? It was Locke, and he only fell about a quarter of the way, and he smashed his leg.
I don't think that's the same well.
Last time someone fell down a well.
Yes, I think it's a different well. Just because of the foliage, the surrounding foliage.
Sure. Yeah. There are, as the man in black explains, many wells.
Many a well.
Yeah, no, I think the well that Locke fell down has to be under a station now, so we would have seen the station above it.
Oh, right.
This one's another well. All right, let's jump to the sideways, the fun part of the episode, because we get to have another run at Hurley and Libby's love story, except this time they're not shipwrecked on an island.
Wait, what about my all caps note?
Oh, I'm sorry. I led up to that, and then I'm sure we would have gotten emails with what it was. Go for it, Joanna.
Sun having no lines bothers me so much. I was already on Sun line count every week, being like, well, there's one for Sun, there's two or whatever. But now she literally has no lines and just like writes notes to her one scene partner, Frank, in the jungle as she's walking. Ugh, it makes me so mad. Anyway, and then, I mean, there was a very, like...
She got hit in the head so hard, Joanna.
She forgot how to...
She can't speak English.
But there was, like, a very sad moment when she gets to the camp and she's looking for Din. Of course, he's not fucking there because the writers hate us. But, I don't know. I feel like that moment needed to be bigger. That moment got kind of swallowed in the whole, like, Jack seeing Kate and Jack seeing Flock. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I Jaquina could have hit me harder with that. Like, I could have stand to have, like, Kate or someone go, like, hug Sun or something, or be like, Jin was just here. I mean, that's probably coming next week. It just felt like, I don't know, justice for Sun in general is all.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
Yeah. It's odd that, I mean, it's cool in a writerly way, but not great in a watching television way, that the only reason Jin isn't there is because they needed his knowledge of a map he made of the island looking for Sun. So if he just hadn't been so good at looking for his wife, he would have probably...
It's because Jin knows where all the wells are.
But he does.
And I think before we go off island, like, I know we talked about this a little bit, but like, I think we need to talk about this moment where Jack talks about Juliet dying and how he can't fix that, mm-hmm. and how he needs to learn to let go. Like, this is a huge thing. This has been, like, part of my thesis for season 6, the post-Juliet death thing, and, like, you know, spoiler alert, it is because I knew he literally says this line where he's like, Juliet's death is the thing that, like, made me really fucking reckon with who the fuck I am. It's a big moment. I don't know, Dave, you've been sort of skeptical about Jack's growth in this season. You can remain skeptical, that's fine, but like, what do you make of this moment for Jack?
I mean, I don't think my skepticism has been becoming the man of faith isn't necessarily the good thing to become, but I don't think that's what Jack is doing yet, because the man of faith is like, we have a purpose, blah blah blah, which I think Jack also might feel, but this episode's Jack is more like, no, Hurley, like, I trust you, we're gonna go with it. And so Jack ceding control as a way of becoming the man of faith is always going to be better for me as a character turn than Jack becoming the man of faith and deciding, you know, he's going to stop all time with Faraday's journal sort of thing. That's also a man of faith thing. That's what I don't like. This, it's just humility. I think I like it.
What about you, Neil?
I mean, you get the double punch of Jack experiencing growth and showing his growth and being supportive of literally everyone's favorite character.
Right.
Who is going through a rough time because ghosts keep telling him what to do. I think that it is. It's one of the strongest moments that we've seen in season six so far, where it's like we get all this character growth. We get this super honest moment between two of the original character, you know, or our most OG of OG 815ers, Hurley and Jack. And I think it's wonderful. And then, you know, almost immediately they go and now they're going to have the standoff with the big bad Men in Black. I love it. I agree with Joanna. I think Jack's arc, Jack obviously has not arced out yet. And his season six arc is really good. Like, it's taking a character that we have rightfully given a really hard time for like 4.5-5 seasons and is slowly bringing him around to a character that we're like, we're rooting for him to figure it out.
And I mean, yeah, not everyone will be. We will have people who hate Jack until the end, and that's fine. But I think
the
reason why he has arcing left to do is that the same reason why he was so frustrating for so long is he finally refused to grow for so long. This is something that like people at the time are complaining about. This is something people watching now are like, what the fuck, Jack? And so like they were just sort of like, what does Big Lock say? There's a difference between doing nothing and waiting. And like, I guess Jack was waiting for his character arc to blossom in the final season, which like makes sense for your protagonist. But like, it felt like a lot of doing nothing Jack-wise for a long time.
It seemed like what he was really waiting for was other people to start taking charge. You know, he's really like, you know, with the LaFleur stuff in when they were time traveling, like, Jack really does seem to thrive when he just gives up power. I think it's a metaphor we should all take to heart.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that was something he was bad at before, because he's like, am I the leader or not? What the fuck? Mm-hmm. Step down, you know, but like,
let me do my own surgeries own body.
Oh my God. But yeah, I mean, like Jack's stepping back and Hurley stepping up, Hurley lying, Hurley for the greater good. He thinks Hurley, taking charge is a really interesting thing. And that's another, like, Hurley still having an arc to do, I think, is because they didn't figure out until late what Hurley's potential was. Because he's a comic relief character. He's an audience surrogate character. But once Jorge Garcia showed them, like, sort of what kind of pathos he could do, and also once I think they just started incorporating his natural ability to make people care about him and make people root for him and make people want to like follow him and be around him. That's just who I think Jorge Garcia is. So that's who like Hurley becomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems like it's one of those things where either they found it late or it's an amazing feat of keeping it secret. Like, it's an amazing long game where they were like, our secret weapon is Jorge Garcia. And Hugo's going to crush this final season. Either way, I'm good with it. I'm glad it happened.
Because I think they thought his arc was he just needs to have confidence in himself so he can, like, kiss a girl. And, like, we get that stuff in this episode, and we're going to talk about that in a second. Dave wanted to pivot off island a million years ago. But, like, that's not all that's on Hurley's mind here. And I think that's really strong.
He has not arced out after kissing Libby.
It's true. And last but not least, we should mention there's the mystery boy in the wood is back.
Just keeps showing up. Is it the same kid, right?
He looks a little
different every time.
Yeah, I think he looks a little older. I don't know. Tall kid. Tall wall.
Tall, dry child.
Tall, dry child.
Michael was dry as well, right?
Ghost, he was. Ghost Michael. Yes.
Yeah. They could have made him wet in one of those scenes just for fun.
My whole ghost logic.
If you're going to remix things from, what, season one?
Make them a little wet.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting while you were talking about that in terms of like Hurley's arc, how like when they were off island, Hurley was the first one to realize like they had to go back and he had to like bring Jack along in that way. But that also means he didn't need like a super good reason to go back to the island, because what happened is he met Jacob and he got a guitar case with an Ankh in it. And like they managed to just sidestep all of that for an entire season by like letting him go to the 70s and be really good at his Dharma job and then come here. And he seems concerned about eventually getting off the island, but he just more seems concerned about keeping everybody okay, which makes him like an excellent audience surrogate. But I think if you foregrounded him much more up until this point, which I think is what Joanna was saying, it would be a lot more difficult, because I think you just have to ham fist a lot more stuff. Yeah, either way, sense. We got here.
So, I actually think job. Hurley's is the most satisfying modulated character growth. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm frustrated because of all the times he refused to move. And I'm just never frustrated with Hurley. I was frustrated with a Hurley episode, but I was never frustrated with Hurley. And the fact that like there's still something interesting cooking in there these many seasons in is really something.
Yeah. Yeah, now can we go to the sideways?
Now we can go to the sideways.
It's so fun. Pierre Chang's at a museum. We get to see Everyone Loves Hugo montage of his life before he gets a paleontology wing named after him. But then his mom, like, rains on his parade like the mothers do.
Yeah. Hurley's mom is such an agent of chaos. I love it.
She is. Right. But, you know, pushes him in good directions when he needs pushing occasionally. Definitely into everything we see from her in the sideways makes sense. We do not see Cheech or Father Dave, as Joanna pointed out. But other than that, things seem to be going good for
Hurley. Where do we think old David Reyes is in the sideways? Do you think he's on good terms with his rich son?
I mean, it's so weird because like you have everything you wanted and he doesn't have Cheech. And really, I feel like that just has to be like a Cheech scheduling issue, and that bothers me.
What was Cheech on in 2010?
Oh, I'll find out. You guys keep talking. I'll look up what Cheech was up to.
Yeah, I just like to imagine that he's chilling at home, like in his bathrobe, while Hurley and his mom got all these things. He just does not go to any of the awards things, but he's just there working on his car, and he's there for chats when Hugo gets home.
You know, maybe he's got a Dave cave.
Maybe he helps.
Oh, he was in Machete.
Maybe he helps Hurley strategize where to do philanthropy, like where he should build parks and hospitals.
Maybe he's like, Hurley, if you donate to this wing, you get a cool dino statue. And Hurley's like, hell yeah.
Well, one of those. Machete, the R-rated spinoff of Spy Kids?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Cool.
He plays Padre Benicio del Toro, which is something I did not know.
Yeah.
That his character's name is Benicio del Toro. Oh, Cheech.
Well, you could have been in the sideways, but you had to be in Machete.
Yeah. Cheech is missing. Also notably missing is Leonard from Santa Rosa. Like the guy playing the Connect Four game is obviously not Leonard. So I miss Leonard a little bit. He's not quite as important as Cheech, but I just wanted to shout him out.
Billion Bane.
Because at first I was like, oh, he's doing the Connect Four game, but he's not mumbling the numbers like he was the first time I saw him. Then I was like, wait, that's not even Leonard. So maybe Leonard's life worked out.
Yeah.
Flash sideways.
Sideways Leonard's living his best life.
Sure.
Like Charlotte. And
he's hanging out.
Chocolate whenever.
He's hanging out with the 4 billion beans lady and her husband. Was it her husband?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sam Toomey.
They're just chilling.
Still has the prize from the fair where he guessed the appropriate amount of beans.
Mm-hmm.
And lived happily ever after. This is what it was like writing the sideways, right? You're just like, who do we want to throw in there? Like you need.
Oh, bad news, Carlton. Carlton, I have bad news. Cheech is, he's making Machete. He can't come.
He can't. Oh, no.
Oh, no, but we had all these fun jokes about the dinosaur statue. Well, throw them out the window. It's just going to be Hurley's mom browbeating him about finding a girlfriend. Sounds great.
Well, he gets set up on a blind date, who apparently stiffs him at a Mexican restaurant, which is, no, stiffs when you leave him with the bill.
Yeah.
Stands him up
at
a Mexican restaurant. That's where he gets to meet Libby on a fajita field trip.
Celebrating Taco Tuesday with her fellow patients.
But she seems to know that they've lived another life or are living another life. She has memories of meeting Hurley before on an island, which leads Hurley to pursue Libby further after, you know, a little pep talk from Desmond. Where do we want to start this conversation?
I have a really good place to start.
Go for it.
On a scale of Jack's baby bangs to Claire's squirrel wig, where do we put Cynthia Watrous's Libby wig in this episode?
It's not quite as bad as Claire's feral wig, but it's pretty rough.
It's not good.
Yeah, it's not their best. Not their season six is where it gets really wild with the wigs, because there's a couple good ones, but then there's, you know, a lot of bad ones.
I feel like they were trying to match her, like, her island hair, and also maybe invoke her being mentally unstable, possibly, in their way that they like to do whenever they really carefully consider mental health storylines in early episodes. But I was not feeling that wig situation.
Sure. Yeah. Although, despite the bad wig, I am overwhelmed with how delightful it is that they were able to get Cynthia Watrous back and bring Libby back. You know, I mean, I know she's there to, like, sort of serve as part of Hurley's storyline, but, you know, you think back to all the characters that you'd want to see back if you have this blank slate of the Flash sideways, and she's definitely on there. I think we've seen, Cheech is probably the first one where I'm like, oh, you know, really, that would have been nice. But yeah, Libby's a great one.
Yeah, I like her showing up. I like the idea that we finally get, like, we're seeing the crush from the other way around. They're both still very gentle with each other because of the mental health issue, but it's flipped, where with Hurley in the episode Dave, this was the problem he was having with approaching Libby just from his other side, which is like the idea of what a people thought I was crazy.
Have we read the quote about why he's called Dave?
No. There's a quote?
An interview with Buddy.TV. David Lindelof says, we like certain biblical names. I think we have read this quote. We like certain biblical names, and David is one of them. David happened to be my father's name. Maybe that's sort of subconsciously rattling around in there. And then Carlton says, the connection between the imaginary Dave and David's father was completely intentional. I mean, we wanted basically Hurley to imagine a friend and have that be wrapped up in his unresolved relationship with his dad. So that's why his imaginary friend is named Dave. But he doesn't mention Libby's or David Shepherd. We'll talk about it. Like I said, this episode reminds me of the episode Dave, and that's just like maybe that's definitely my least favorite early episode. There's just like stuff with his like weight and stuff with mental health that, again, I just don't feel like is perfectly threaded.
Sure.
It is nice to see Cynthia Watrous here, and I do love Hurley and Libby, so that's true.
Mm-hmm. I also love that they're adding a little bit of like dynamism to what kind of things tear at the fabric between our main reality and the Flash sideways, right? So like we saw Charlie, it was a near-death experience, and then he drives Desmond off a pier, and also a near-death experience. But in this episode, we get sort of two different ones. Like Libby starts to see her other life after seeing Hurley on TV. And then Hurley only starts to see his other life after, they kiss. So it's like you can do it with the near-death experience. You can also do it with love. And then, of course, TBD on what just happened to John Locke there at the end.
Can you just do it with kissing?
Right.
Could Desmond just be running around just kissing people?
Yeah.
I mean, you shouldn't kiss people without their consent. But sure. If it wakes them up to another but parallel reality,
I mean, what is a
point.
What is a hit and run if not a car kissing a body?
Yeah, and I like that too. That element where it's like, all right, this episode is now establishing that like love and connection can sort of break through the barrier between realities, and you know, you think, oh, well, now this is going to be a theme, and then Desmond hits John Locke with his car. So who knows anything anymore?
I don't remember. I'm honestly asking this because I don't remember. Not that like I this isn't. Anyway, the point is, like, do you think Desmond was just trying to give John the same experience that he and Charlie had in the harbor or whatever, and with the bag of heroin, or do you think he's trying to put him on a course with Jack?
Oh, yeah.
Or I mean, is he really mad that he got thrown down a well and thrown into another reality?
That's another one. Like, if Desmond, you know, man out of time, is communing back and forth between these two versions of reality, he's probably pissed off at John Locke at this point for chucking
him
down
the well.
Well,
and Desmond doesn't know that that wasn't John Locke that threw him down the well. He's not cued into the smoke monster thing, so why not?
Something that I... So something that we didn't talk about last week with Desmond's episode, but that our live watchers were definitely very wound up about, was that they thought it was very creepy of Desmond to go to, first of all, they thought it was creepy of Daniel Faraday to tell Desmond where his sister was. Secondly, they thought it was very creepy of Desmond to go to a stadium at night where a woman is running alone and walk up to her and talk to her. If it were one of our listeners doing it, that Desmond would have gotten maced or kicked in the balls or something like that. Mm-hmm.
This is the say anything conundrum.
I support all of this reaction, but I do want to say that, like, and I'm sorry we didn't mention it last week, but I do want to say that, like, something that I think I mentioned last week, but it's definitely true, is that someone was calling Desmond's theme in this season Desmond's creeper theme, and that is definitely true in this episode, where he's just like creeping around chicken shops and like school parking lots, and the no less than Ben Linus is like, excuse me, sir, you are extremely handsome but also creepy, so could you not?
I've noticed you've been watching the children.
Right. And it doesn't help that he has like a wound on his head. Yeah. He looks like he just got his ass kicked. It's like, what?
Quick. Tell me your child's name.
Right. Shout out to Dr. Linus, though. Very responsible, observant teacher slash, I guess. Well, no, he's still just a teacher. He's not an administrator. Didn't quite win in the coup.
Oh, yeah. A failed coup for Ben Linus. But yeah, Dr. Ben Linus, a lovely man. I think,
sure.
You know, Mr. Locke.
Protecting those damn kids.
Yeah. So, So Desmond is a creeper this season, but a creeper for good, maybe.
I mean, he could have just leaned out the window and kissed Ben, right? And then Ben would have been like, yeah. Oh, yeah, never mind. Hit that guy with a car. Got weird memories where he made me stab God to just make him get him out of here. All right. I like this thing that's in the notes, and I think we orbited around it, but I think it's worth saying verbatim. I think this is Joanna, so all credit to Joanna here, but it isn't like... The thing that Hurley has, good luck, isn't what truly matters. It's having the confidence to pursue the thing that really matters. I think that's the thing that's connecting our main losties to these memories or flashes of this other timeline, is once they're able to fully give way to that pursuit. For Charlie, that means a near-death experience. For Desmond, it means like maybe angering his boss to go around and try to find his one true love, and then also communicate with these other people. And then for Hurley, it's just, you know, you deserve happiness. Someone doesn't have to be crazy to love you, which I think is a little bit of a revert back to his previous thing, but it's great to see it play out in one episode, I think, a little bit cleanly. Given the previous caveats Joanna said about drowning your sorrows in fried chicken and mental health preconceptions / wigs.
Wigs, wigs, wigs. Yeah, it's interesting, this idea of like you're presented with a reality of what you've always wanted, something that is supposed to sort of like, and this universe, whatever this is like, is intent on throwing obstacles in the path of these people from finding these things, right? Like for Desmond, it's Eloise, like trying to keep him from Penny and stuff like that. And for Hurley, it's like the doctor at Santa Rosa trying to keep him away from Libby, right? Like there are obstacles. So it has to not just be
solution
like.
The solution to both is having money.
Money! Like the fajita field trip meet cute is not enough. Like Hurley has to be an active, take an active role in his journey here. And that's similar to like what Charlie's like, go find Penny, go do it to Desmond. So, you know, it's just, it's interesting to watch what these actual movements are.
Are the people who we've seen, like show up pre knowledgeable about both universes, which I think have been like Libby and Faraday, is it because their sideways situations don't have blocks placed in front of them? Like Faraday can hold the concert with Driveshaft and wear that hat, and Libby is voluntarily in a mental hospital. It seems like they're already on their way to pursuing things that they want. You know, they're not letting the bullshit get in their way.
Maybe, but like, I bet you if Eloise knew that Daniel had seen some chocolate eating hussy at the museum, she would have put a stop to it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I love that there's no one to tell Daniel no to that hat. a theory that I saw floating around some of the recaps is that Charlie and Libby and Faraday were all able to wake up maybe a little easier because they're already dead.
Oh.
But I don't know if that's the case because John Locke is dead and he's with Helen, and that's not ringing any bells for him, so I don't know if there's a real consistent.
Yeah. Also, Arst is in this. We've seen him in the sideways, and he seems to just be existing as a teacher.
Roger Workman's had years to figure his. Oh, that's who I want stepping out of the fucking bushes and explaining the whispers. That's somebody who's was bad enough and died on the island that I don't mind if he has to figure some shit out.
Oh, Roger.
But yeah, Roger Workman's not connected to like a Hurley Libby plot. Like they're trying to like group these return people, aren't they?
I'm just going back to trying to make myself feel better about the goddamn whispers. But I guess, you know, I could do that for ever. And what is it? It's 2021 for over 10 years, 15 years, even 10 years, still 2010. OK, we got connections today. We got how are people more connected to the process of waking up? We have one thing here that goes back to the money about maybe why Desmond shows up at this chicken this chicken shop. And he goes from stadium to chicken shop, ditches Frank along the way, but shows up with
George Minkowski. You're a creep.
I'll drive myself now, brother.
Yeah, give me the manifest and then kindly fuck off. Thank you so much.
And then away you go. But he's now targeted somebody who has the means to, you know, bribe mental health facilities.
I like to think that that's why Hurley's first. I mean, maybe Hurley's first because he's just like the best human. But like, I also, if I'm Desmond and I'm like, how am I going to like contact all these people on the manifest? I'm targeting the richest guy I know. On the flight, and that's Hurley. So
yeah, you can't hit, like, Widmore's wife's onto you. You've dismissed his driver. Like, you're gonna need another way of bopping around Los
Angeles. It turns out the three ways to tear the fabric between realities are a near death experience, love, and money.
Money. And something I should say is that what I was seeing in the recaps that I was reading is that maybe people were frustrated with the sideways in the first half of the season because they felt like kind of like a little bit of a circle jerk, like that they were like, what is this? Why am I supposed to care about? What am I watching? Mm-hmm. And so ever since last week with Desmond's episode, they're like, okay, I'm watching. I get it. I kind of get what I'm watching here, which is like, we got a mission. We're on a mission. There's forward momentum. It's not just like a fun little what if exercise. It's something, and it's connected to this other story that I'm watching. And so I think the flash side, but like for those of us rewatching, we already know about that connection. And so I think on rewatch, The Flash Sideways is just fun from the start, other than Kate's dumb episode. Because, you know, it's just a fun, like, oh, hey, there's Helen. Mm-hmm. Oh, hey, there's whoever. You know what I mean? So yeah. Oh, yeah. Kiwi. He makes good eggs.
Yeah, it's Kiwi. He's got eggs. It's fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, now we've got this purpose and then maybe an antagonist. That's the other thing that Eloise provided for us. So what good is having a purpose without an antagonist, I say? Right, true. John Locke? I think it's good. All right. I think it's time for some corners. Neil, we got some Giacchino corner this week.
We do. We've got three good ones. The first is, I believe, the music from the opening scene. It's called A Hugo Reyes of Light.
Nice.
It's great. This actually is a, I think it's a theme we've heard before, but they bring it back. We also get one that is new and will be coming back to a new orchestral piece called Passing the Torch, which is plays over the scene that Jack and Hurley are sort of having their moment. But of course the real killer is at the end. This is a mix of some new orchestral work from Giacchino. And then there's a little bit of Hurley's theme. And then it ends a little bit of Desmond's Flash Sideways theme. It's called A Memorable Kiss. And I think that one's pretty good. That's a good, it's a good title. It's a great moment. Giacchino continues to kill it here in season six.
He's back for season six.
He really, you know, he, I would say has maintained the quality of his scoring work throughout the entire series. Like the score of Lost is always good, but he also seems to have put a little bit more energy into his titles.
Hugo Reyes of Light.
Right.
Worth it. Our jungle mystery moment is Ghost Michael and the Whispers. That's the answer. I hope you feel good about it. The dumb, elaborate artifact of the week. Rest in peace to the original OG artifact, the Black Rock, which was not a rock at all, but a slave ship that brought Richard here and got blown up with lots of dynamite.
It was an old wooden ship.
Old wooden ship. The Boon, Carlisle Memorial falling down award. It is a banner day in the history of the Storm podcast as we have two. We've tied. They're either tied or we get a sideways one.
It's almost like we've been working up to this by giving out this award since season one.
We got both Desmond thrown down a well. Very dramatic. We don't know how far it was, so we can't judge distance. But then also, John Locke gets hit by a car and goes up onto the car and then falls down off of the car. It is very traumatic looking. I bet we have to find out next week how he's doing.
Okay. Something we should mention is that yeah, Locke throws Desmond down the well and then Desmond hits Locke with his car. Some people are wondering if that's related.
They're just causing each other to fall down across multiple different realities.
It's a circle. It's a cycle.
The John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award, of course, goes to Libby. Welcome back, Libby. We've guessed where you were for long periods of time in all of our Flash Sideways that were in the past. Or flashbacks, that's how you do that. All your flashbacks that were in the past, now we see you in the Flash Sideways. Welcome back, Libby. Where was Libby? She was in another dimension.
We found Libby. She was on a Fajita field trip. Also, they got their beach picnic and Hurley brought the blankets.
We love you coming back, Libby. Mm-hmm. I hope you stay okay.
Yeah, stay okay.
The Abs Eterno Award. Tough one this week, but we're going to give it to evil Saeed Abs that just menace and keep him standing incredibly upright. The Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award. Doesn't go to Ben this week. It goes to Hurley, who lies about seeing Jacob. Hurley learns what it takes to be a leader of this, people who are stubborn like Richard and Jack. It's lying.
We'd have to go back and check the tape, but I think this might be the first time that Hurley has won the lying award.
Probably.
It has to be, right?
I feel like he's done some like bad lies before. Like, I feel like we've seen Hurley lie badly in the past, but yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff around the hatch and the food that I don't like, but at that point, Ben was in the show, right? No, he came in right afterwards.
I think other, like, ghost-related lies or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Spot the difference corner. We get to see Dr. Pierre Chang this time. He definitely works at that museum. That museum seems to be like a nexus point for our lost side characters. That's the museum that Charlotte works at, which we learned from Miles. And then that also museum is close to where they're holding the Faraday concert, because Faraday has been creeping on Charlotte. The nexus point. But now it has a Hugo Reyes paleontology wing, which is fantastic. Everybody needs to learn more about dinosaurs. Okay, it's time for our Jungle of Kistery moment for Happily Ever After, which has both Desmond and Penny in it. But what did we decide to do, Joanna?
I mean, Diana kind of, our producer Diana kind of, it was her job to make the call on the Kistery poll, and she did. She said, no Desmond plus Penny. That was too obvious. They're going to win. We're not doing it. So.
I like that energy. That's.
I actually don't think Penny is in this poll. It's just Des and Charlie. So Desmond and falling down 8.6% of the vote.
Oh, they should have just waited a week.
Yeah. Charlie's butt in our eyes, 15.7% of the vote. Desmond and Faraday and the truth, 35.7% of the vote. I can't believe the hat didn't make the poll. And then, but edging out ahead, it's Desmond and Charlie over some drinks at, I believe the bar is called Jack's.
Jack's.
40% of the vote. So it's Desmond and Charlie, the brothers. There you go.
Desmond and Charlie and the ocean and the car.
I think that's what falling down would be, because I don't think there's a significant, you know, that, but he does go, deep down in the ocean.
Into a marina.
Yeah. And then this week, down a well. Des really kept picking up the falling down for season 6. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award. Here you go, guys. Hugo, I'm looking out for your best interests. All of you. Nothing is more important than this. That thing is evil, and God help us if it ever leaves this island. Because if it, and then I drop the dynamite and blow up, because I'm Alana!
they didn't even have, like, fun gooey Alana bits. It was really, like, charcoal, it was, like, lava rock, volcanic rock.
Alana. She had significantly more dynamite on her than Arst did. Like, Arst was, like,
was it
blown into large chunks, and Alana was evaporated.
It's bad. And they just kind of rolled on pretty quickly. I mean, I will say this, RIP Alana, I really, really love that moment in Ben's episode, Dr. Linus, where she's like, I'll have you. I always love that moment. It gets me every time. That's the only good use of your character. I'm sorry you were such a waste of space.
you arced out when you dared have a two-hander with Michael Emerson. all right, the Frank Lapidus, guess we're not going to Guam Act Break Award. We have two here, but I'm going to make an executive decision to go with Michael. Who pops out, just strolls out of the jungle after he saw him blow up on the freighter and says, I'm here to stop you from getting everyone killed. Dun, dun, dun. And maybe did, even though that also involved blowing up a boat.
I love whenever it was one of those great, like, it's kind of hacky, but still great reveals when, like, the camera shows you, like, someone's shoulder and hey, and you're like, whoever. He just says, like, hey, or something like, or whatever. Hurley looks at him. But it's just, you just see shoulder and you're like, whoever this is, it's going to be fun. And then it's Michael. It's
Michael.
It's like it's Mikhail, but it's Michael.
He did come back twice now. So that's a lot of coming back. all right. It's time for the official podcast check-in. They're back doing podcasts, which means the finale this time in 2010 would be being edited. It's being shot. They answer a lot of questions about why Daniel Faraday has the last name Faraday, despite being a Widmore. And the answer was because Eloise didn't want Charles to find Daniel until he absolutely had to, because she knew she had to complete Daniel's loop. Anyway, but then they have this moment.
Hey, by the way, speaking of space-time continuum, let me just ask you a quick follow-up question from Chris Cascoon. from PA.
Okay.
So we know that most of the characters' lives are different in The Flash Sideways, but what I want to know is, do Nikki and Paolo still suck in that timeline?
A lot of people have been asking, and by a lot of people I mean you, about Nikki and Paolo and whether or not they'll appear in the Sideways. I like to think that Nikki and Paolo are having an awesome, awesome life in the Flash Sideways. And the difference because things are awesome in The Flash Sideways, it feels like, why make the mistake that you made the first time around by introducing them into the core cadre of the show? Let's just assume that they're off. She's on season 5 of Exposé. Paolo is still cooking for that guy in Australia, and everything is just progressing lovingly.
Yeah, so she's still married to that producer dude, probably.
Yes, that would be my guess.
All right.
So that's the answer of Nikki and Paolo. I hope we weren't waiting for more closure in season 6.
Wow, we got whispers and Nikki and Paolo answers in the same episode?
I mean, really, that's the episode of the podcast. So only here on The Storm do you get those two answers bundled together, along with the rest of the answers in The Storm right after this.
All right, now is the time of the show where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. These are the folks that we nowadays like to call our candidates. Let's start with some newcomers. We've got Julian, Andrew K. Baggett, Sean Huff. I'm basing that off of the Derek and Julian Huff pronunciation. Katie Wade, Lauren Galbraith, Ryan Casas or Casas, Suniva Agard, Christopher Mack, James DeVores, Malik Birkenfeld, Electric Sheep TV. I said Mikhail. Michael Lisi, James, Matt Gray, JP Gicken, DJ Trish, Anthony Memo, Erica Kremenik, Mike Munster, and Jennifer Carnival or Carnivale, probably. Thank you all so much.
And I have things I'm going to add to, and would not, I would have done Sean as Sean. So we're lucky that I'm going to pronounce as best as I can. Thank you to Alejandro Pozos, Sarah Finnemore, Damon Van Buren, Josh, Mary Henderson, Seth Freelick, Jessica Scott, Matthew Wilson, Sarah Cooper, Craig Cargyle, Robert G. Payne, Jeff Libby, Brian, Matthew Munden, Mark Rodriguez, Jessica Trowbridge, Jay Fornes, Francis Adrian, Kevin Gonzalez, oh, I pronounced that one right. And Jay Maggio, thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the fine humans on this following list. Eric Procyse, Arthur Wynn, Scott Rumsey, Richard Hoska, Tracy, Jason, Eric Manley, Daniel Steer, Joseph Lucis, Francis Adrian, Ralph Helm, Chelsea Patchell, Samuel Fry, Fran Bull, Sam, Tony Rollins, Courtney Rollins, Akil Kassam, Elizabeth Maxiner, and Elizabeth Gelly. Thank you all very much for being members of the Old Small Council.
And we're back for The Storm. Where I, start this off by reminding everybody to be high energy and by apologizing for not starting the calm off with calm-related questions, apparently.
No, I mean, I just don't know. Like, you ask those questions and they're good questions. I just literally don't know how to answer them.
Yeah, you know it was kind of tough. That being said, Neil fucking killed it.
So he did.
It can't be that hard.
You're right.
They'll never know.
Well, to that end, it's funny. Like, the reason I got resistant to that is I just had written down in my notes that when Richard's like, well, we're gonna go blow up the plane or whatever, and it's him and Ben and Miles. I was like, hey, all those three dudes make it. So. Team Richard was the way to go. I mean, mm-hmm. Hurley also survives and Frank also survives, but Son and Jack don't. So Team Hurley has the lower success rate than Team Richard Dynamite.
Yeah.
They all win.
That's a good point.
Turns out trying to broker peace with an all-time evil entity that is inhabiting the body of your former friend John.
Dangerous.
Yeah, not the best plan.
Also, I love this moment in this episode where Jack is telling Richard what he promised son, and then I think Richard says, "I wish you hadn't done that." And I'm like, that's how all of us feel.
We felt like that while it was happening.
When you were promising her, we were like, ooh, I wish you hadn't done
that. Is that the worst thing Jack does in season six, is promise son that he's going to get her back with Jin and off the island?
I just like, I'm like, they had to have known what was going to happen at this point. Why do they keep saddling Jack with this? We're working on a redemption arc. Stop reminding us what Jack promised, what he's going to fail to do. Gonna get another woman killed. Oh no.
Yeah. Also, Desmond's gonna be in that well for a while.
Yep.
Yep. Until the finale, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Think
there's
so.
Only six more episodes left, so.
Oh boy. Desmond. Should have stayed with the solenoids, buddy.
I guess this is the one where the island stuff is super wheel spinny. Not like there's a difference between like
not donkey wheel spinny.
Sorry. Right. There's a difference between, I think, like filler and wheel spinny, and like the temple is like bad filler that I don't like. But this feels like absolutely wheel spinny. Like no one goes anywhere.
Yeah. Locke's camp is just where all momentum goes to die. Everyone's just sitting. It's like doldrums. Everyone. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, there's a difference between waiting and something. Not really. No, there isn't.
Is there?
Yeah, Sawyer's right. You're just sitting here.
Yeah. You're like not going out, getting any of these people. I don't understand like how omniscient you are. It's a messy part of the island plot for sure.
I just looked at the transcript and Richard says, "Well, Jack, I wish you hadn't done that."
Yeah.
Yep. Oh boy. You guys want to hear some emails?
Yeah, let's hear absolutely. Some emails.
Okay. So, Matthew Wilson, who's been a great emailer this entire time, wrote in and says, "The divisive response to the Lost finale is usually put down to the difference between people who wanted more answers to the mysteries and those who were more invested in the characters. Although I would put myself in the latter category, and I love the finale, this rewatch is really showing, as you all pointed out last week, how much padding there is in the on-island storyline. Seems to me that there's plenty of space within the season to answer or pay off some of the earlier storylines and still do the same character work in the sideways. Here are my suggestions. We do technically get an answer to the Whispers, but it's done in a pretty boring way. Why not have a standalone episode in the style of The Lighthouse about the Whispers and give Michael more to do? And since the epilogue implies that Walt will go back to the island to save Michael, why not do that in season 6? Get Widmore to kidnap Walt as well as Desmond, because we know Walt is special. And then give Walt a mission in setting Michael free. Love that. Love this. Okay, moving on. Mm-hmm. Point number two. Make the temple stuff at the start of the season, but longer, but also less stupid. I know it's easier said than done, but how about making Dogen less antagonistic towards the candidates? Instead of refusing to tell them anything, he could be trying to work out their strengths to see which of them is most suitable. Why not get Dogen to send Jack to the lighthouse instead of him trying to stop that? Three, get Sun and Jin together earlier. Could Widmore maybe capture Sun after he gets a hold of Jin as a mark of respect after their meeting during the flash forwards? I know I have two more Widmore kidnappings in my list, but he seems to be good at it.
Yeah.
Any other pitches for making the season 6 on-island stuff work better? I used to think an Alana flashback would be fun, but these days I'm not so sure. Matthew." So I love all of this. This is all great stuff, mm-hmm. I think. Especially love the idea of, I mean, bringing Walt onto the island and not leaving Walt in the epilogue, I think would have gone a long way towards people feeling less salty about the final season. What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also like the idea about putting Sun and Jin together a little bit earlier. Again, I think I mentioned this before, like, why doesn't Frank just say, "Hey, Sun, you and I are going to go find like Jin"? Like, why isn't that the mission? Why do they need to be anywhere near Jack and Hurley? So yeah, I like that. I'm trying to think other things that would make the island more interesting. I don't know. It really does. One of the things that bothers me, and it comes up in this episode a little bit, is that, you know, Sawyer really doesn't have a whole lot to do. He will here shortly. But I don't know. I think having Sawyer be just sit there at Locke's camp for three, four episodes now just is super boring to me.
Yeah, I would say I would want to know, I would want there to be two distinct sides earlier. Like, when we finally get to Jack being like, you disrespect fucking John Locke's skin, I'm going to, like, stop you. Like, that could have been, I think, much earlier, even before Jack and Locke were in the same place. But there's this weird idea at the beginning of season six that, like, Jack is obsessed with Jacob, but our problem is the smoke monster, and, like, that he's never in a position to learn that that's what he's up against until very, very late. So, like, give the story an antagonist. Otherwise, the antagonist is the pacing of the story, I feel like. Because I just want to, like, it's a weird feeling during season six, because when the episodes end, you're like, I want to keep going. But, like, that's the episode of television, and it was, you know, not satisfying. So I could see where it's good enough in broadcast, barreling towards this finale, to just still have cliffhangers. But in terms of making episodes of television, I think there needed to be more defined lines from, like, the beginning. Like, these people are good, these people are bad, the bad person's really good at conning people, Sawyer's maybe trying to pull, like, a double con. Like, that whole Jack and Anna Lucia were gonna build an army to fight the others. Like, you could have brought that back and actually done it with your season six budget instead of building a temple set, and it would have been, like, kind of interesting. Why did the good guys in, like, the fight against the smoke monster just leave all of the Dharma stations, like, unused? There's a station with, like, inert gas that just vents everywhere, apparently. There's a whole bunch of things. I don't know.
I
wanted it to be a volcano at the end.
I think giving Sawyer more, like, missions to do, and Ben more lying to do for the on the side of good or stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there's, like, fun action-y stuff that they could be doing on Island rather than just, like, let's throw Desmond on the well for four episodes. Okay, I have to help us with this question. I have an article that I pulled up from Digital Spy. It's the kind of article that I usually roll my eyes at, but, like, for the sake of this argument, it's Lost: 9 unanswered questions and unresolved issues we still have today. And listen, I don't think as we discussed in the calm with the leftovers, I don't think you need answers to questions to make it a satisfying story, but it could be a useful thought experiment. Like, was there a way to answer some of these questions or tie up, you know, close the loop on some of these things in a way that could have produced a fun episode, a fun action-y episode? Not Michael walking out of the jungle being like, yep, the dead people. Okay.
It was me. I'm the Whispers in the show that's all about heaven. I'm not going to be there. I'm trapped on the island.
All right. So Jacob's cabin. That's one on this list. Libby's whole thing.
Just Libby. Libby.
Libby in general.
The outrigger chase. That would have been so easy for them to, And for those, I mean, I assume if you're in the storm, you know what I mean by when I said the outrigger chase. But in case you're not, there was, like, the moment in season five, time hopping moment where our heroes and the outrigger are shot at on the water. The plan was to eventually show us who was shooting at them, but they never did it. And so it's just left hanging there. Number four, Walt, which we talked about. Number five, Eloise Hawking. Sort of like, what does she know? When does she know it? Number six, the sickness. And this is one that really bugs me. So I would have loved to felt a little bit more settled on the sickness, the childbirth problems, and the numbers. And then there's a list of honorable mentions, which I think might be even more fun. Okay, so there was, like, what are the rules that were spoken about by Ben, Widmore, Man in Black, and Jacob? Why did Christian Shepherd appear to Jack and Michael off the island if the Man in Black couldn't leave? What happened to the De Groots and Alvar Hanzo? Where did the bodies of Christian Shepherd and Yemi go? Where did the glass eye come from? Presumably it's Mikhail's. Who built the statue? Why did Rudzinski make the blast door map and shoot himself? Why did Penny know so much about the island? Why can the Man in Black only appear as those who have died? Why did the Man in Black decide to kill Echo and not the others? How come the others and Ben had so much money? What happened to Ben's childhood friend, Annie? Annie, where are you? Who made the secret door that supposedly summons the Man in Black? Yes, the fucking drain summoning thing. Who built the temple? Why did Frank, Ben, and Son not travel through time? Who built the magic lighthouse, and how the hell did it work? Why did the man in black kill the innocent Ajira flight passengers? And was David Shepard a real person in the Flash Sideways
universe? No, he's Cheech.
He's Stardust.
That's what makes me feel so much better about Cheech not being in the Sideways. Oh. Is because that was the piece I was missing. Is how does how are all David's one David?
Oh, they recast Cheech with Dylan Minnette.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's just as long as there aren't two Davids that we know to be the Davids in one place, all Davids is still a theory.
Are these maybe, like time cop
hypothesis?
Time cop rules? Like if you have two Davids, if two Davids touch each other in the Flash Sideways,
if there were two Davids in the Flash Sideways, we'd have a question about, you know, are there multiple Davids? But I think it still holds up that there's possibly only one David in the entirety of Lost.
Anyway, I really liked Matthew's suggestions. If you guys have other fan fiction for the final season you guys want to write in, I would happily read it. What could our Losties be doing? Kate should be climbing trees. You know, like Sawyer should be taking his shirt off to do something. Like there are skills that our Losties have that are not being used.
Like going back to like this idea that they could have introduced the conflict between Team Jack and Team Flock a little bit earlier, you then could get a scene where like Sawyer is like shirtless building some sort of barricade or weapon, like chopping down trees to prepare for a giant battle on Hurley's golf course or some shit. Yeah, I mean they never end up fighting the actual smoke monster, which, you know, a little bit of a disappointment there. Like I would have loved like an episode sort of in the middle of season six where they try to kill him as the smoke monster and they come up with all these different ways and they all go horribly wrong. Like you could still get to the end where he has to be like trapped in John Locke's body and, you know, killed because now he's mortal. But I wanted an episode where like it all goes wrong and the smoke monster almost kills them, but can't because they're candidates, right?
Yeah, supposedly. Skip the dagger, do something else, but with that like thing. I like it. Give them some hope that they could defeat something monstrous, and then let them, you know, halfway through the season, get the shit kicked out of them. Yeah. I'm into that.
Send Gendry down into the forge to make dragonglass swords for everyone. It'll be fine. All right.
Basically, they're doing okay with, like, power creep. I mean, Hurley's now like coming to his own, and Miles is no longer Ghost Guy because he could only do recently dead, and Alana's in pieces. So I feel like, yeah, you could have just leaned into everybody's power creep archetype for like this battle scene. Like, you know, Kate could be in the trees, like all those things. Shirtless Sawyer. That's what we wanted to see.
Do you think maybe they were worried they would feel a little like to Return of the Jedi Ewok battle or something like that? But I like the Ewok battle, so I'm on the right side, the correct side of the Ewok line. Do you guys know about the Ewok line?
No. I mean, maybe.
Okay, hold on. Let me look it up.
Oh, this is a term.
Yeah. The Ewok line.
I could have guessed it what it was, which is like,
oh god, it's from How I Met Your Mother. I didn't realize that. Anyway, that makes
that's
me less
fine.
Excited
it's,
about
that means
it.
It's yours now.
If you were born before 1973, you don't like Ewok line, the Ewoks. If you were born after 1973, you're like, Ewoks are cool.
Ah, that's like a Jar Jar Binks line that exists somewhere around 1996.
Yeah. The Binks line. Yeah.
The Binks line.
Yeah. So May 25th, 1973, you were born on the wrong side of that. You think Ewoks are dumb. But if you're like us and you're millennials or elder millennials or younger, you're like, Ewoks, they rule. All right.
Yeah. Fine, at least.
They're fine. Yeah, they're fine. They're not my favorite thing, but I'm not like, ugh, Ewoks. I get sad when that one dies. All right. Anyway, this one's from Abby, who says, hi from Texas. 2! I just finished getting caught up after starting the podcast in March, so I thought I would email and share my origin story opinions and continue the trend of being literal children when Lost first aired.
Oh my god.
No.
I was 6 in 2004, so I didn't start watching when the show started for obvious reasons. I was in middle schoolish when Lost finished, and all I knew about it was that it had polar bears on a tropical island, and I thought that was dumb. I didn't get why it was all over TV / always being talked about. My parents loved it, though, my mom especially. She tried for years to get me to watch it. I refused solely because I was not down. Polar bears? on a beach. My mom finally got me to watch it Christmas break of freshman year of college circa 2016. She promised the polar bears were not that big of a deal. Throughout the 4 years of college, my mom and I would watch whenever I was home on break. I love this. We ended up finishing my senior year during spring 2020, aka quarantine. I was really upset with the end of it all at first. I felt like it was too anticlimactic and the show deserved a more exciting finish. Read, I was definitely projecting my feelings about college ending abruptly due to COVID. I decided I like the end more now that I'm done being bitter about a lame end to college and separated the two things in my brain. Anyways, I actually ended up loving Lost, even though I pretended to hate it until the very end. It's definitely in my top five shows now. Since it's only been a year since I finished the show, my opinions haven't really evolved much, but I'm interested to see if they do when I'm a real grown-up. But here they are. Abby, you're a real grown-up. Okay. Number one. I always hated Jack. He reminded me of Dan from Gossip Girl. Very pick-me energy. Number two. Loved Charlie during at first because I thought he was a punk rock groupie. Now I think he's kind of an idiot, but in a good way. Number three. Claire and Charlie should have never been a thing. That was a hot mess from the start. Number four. Sawyer's character arc is god tier, and his relationship with Juliet was too pure for this world. Number five, I'm still bitter about Sun and Jin, and probably will be forever. And number six, Ben is an icon, evil but iconic. TV shows have always been something my mom and I shared. She even showed me this podcast. She's not caught up yet, so this gets read in the pod. Hi, Mom. Still not down with polar bears, Abby. So that was Abby's journey through Lost, which I really liked.
Oh, that polar bear show? No.
No.
I mean, her mom was right. The polar bears really didn't matter.
It's true. True. But I do. I mean, that was such the iconography from the first season. You know what I mean?
That is true. Yeah.
All right. Well, those are all the emails I have to write. Is there anything else we have in the storm section this week?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yes. All right. Now's the time. We get salty about we get salty all the time about Saeed and Shannon in the church, right? Mm-hmm. Here's why I'm salty about Libby. I love Libby. Libby's great. But Libby is someone Hurley knew for like literally a couple days. And her being his most important or whatever presumes that Hurley never met someone to spend his life with once he becomes like a literal island god. And I don't like that for Hurley. I like to believe that he became this really great at his job island god, passed the torch to Walt whenever Walt felt like it was time for him to do it. Ben was his second in command, but like Hurley, I feel like definitely had a fulfilling romantic relationship at some point in his goddom. So I don't like for Hurley that Libby is the end all be all of everything. They knew each other for a couple days.
Yeah,
that's all.
That's I mean, I think that's most fair because of the context that Hurley goes on for he lives on his life for so much longer after the events of the show. I definitely did want a little bit better for Hurley. Even though it's a sweet moment, you know, it's nice to have, I guess it's just the TV shorthand of it. It's like, well, we can't have someone else be in the church with Hurley and then not explain who that is. But, yeah, sad times. Sad. It makes Hurley's story very sad in the end.
Yeah.
Unless he did meet someone and had a really great time. And lived a long life and gets the afterlife and realizes, oh, wait, it actually was Libby. That would be pretty wild. I'd be confused if I were him.
I also want to talk about this, the phrase let go, which Jack says in this episode, maybe I'm supposed to let go. Is, you know, he says what? You have no idea. Ever since Juliet died, ever since I got her killed, all I wanted was to fix it, but I can't. I can't ever fix it. What a thing for Jack to say, right? You've no idea how hard it is for me to sit back and listen to other people tell me what I should do, but I think maybe that's the point. Maybe I'm supposed to let go, right? There's a Lostpedia, a really handy Lostpedia stub page that's like regularly spoken phrases, and let go is obviously one of them. But like, you know, we got like Rose saying to Jack, like, you can let go in LAX part one. What makes you think letting go is so easy? Locke to Jack and the candidate. You can let it go. Jack to Locke. And then, you know, at the very end, Christian Schiff said to remember and to let go. So it's just this whole, like, what is Jack holding on to? This idea of who he's supposed to be or who he has to be in order to be worthy or whatever. And this idea of letting go, which I find so emotional and pure in this final season. What do you guys think?
Yeah,
I like it. I mean, I like it thematically for the end of Lost and for Jack as a constant advocate for having logical reasons for what you're doing. I don't know, I could say it's 100% good advice across all the thing, but good fictional advice for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it works perfectly for sort of the end of Jack's arc, you know, cause that is one of the more frustrating things about Jack for most of the show is that he can't let things go.
Another, you know? Another couple moments are like Boone says to Jack, "Let me go, Jack." Right? Like that Boone, the like the Boone guillotine storyline is like such a prime example of Jack not letting the fuck go. So yeah.
We can sharpen this luggage container. Oh, ho, ho, ho. All right, buddy. Said you were a doctor. All right. I think that's gonna do it for this week and everybody loving Hugo. We're gonna keep loving Hugo as we move on. Spoiler alert. Neil. Mm-hmm. Where we go next week?
Well, next week we're going to find out who is the last recruit. It is an episode that has a bunch of different Flash sideways. It's. I think we're done with. Right? Is this true? Yes, we are done with individually specific character episodes. Flash sideways. So, like this is a Hurley episode, but the next few are either a bunch of different characters or they're like, you know, Jack and Locke and Jack and the Man in Black.
Or take place way in the past with none of our recognizable cast.
Right. Oh, Nelson exactly. Janney's here.
Right. So we're done with sort of exploring the Flash sideways through the lens of a single character's experience. And it's about to get very chaotic.
We're in the end game now. Until next week, when we try to figure out who the last recruit is and recruit him. Where can people find your work online? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me wrapping up some Loki stuff over on vanityfair.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. That's about all I got to say.
And Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always see some of my work, filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot. That is a fun one. And don't forget to join us for Movie Club in the Slack. It's going to be fun. We're going to watch Sneakers.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You could follow me on Twitter by going to journalismdiedthedaytheinternetwasborn.com. And you could listen to me on Fighting in the War Room. It's another podcast about pop culture. We watched Space Jam, A New Legacy. And boy, did we have things to say about it.
Why?
You know, because it was there. HBO Max, man, during a pandemic. I've watched a lot of stuff. We watched that the Soderbergh movie, which was good, versus Space Jam, which was not. Anyway, the important thing is I'll be right here for the next 6 weeks, at least, telling you at the end of an episode about Lost to not fall down. Do not be well, Desmond. It's your new goal in life.
Do not be Carlock.